Good morning. Glad you made it so early and you could actually find the room all the way down the hall. So it's great to see so many of you here. I'm Dr. Laura Anderko, and I'd just like to recognize my two partners in this initiative, Dr. John Davies Cole from the D.C. Department of Health, who cannot be here, and a former undergraduate student of mine in my epidemiology class, Andrew Strunk, who is now working on his MPH and PhD in epidemiology and public health at Boston University. So he's in class, couldn't make it. And I unfortunately have no disclosures, but I guess in some ways that's kind of good. So I was going to ask the question, not realizing that Dr. Frumkin was going to be here, how many of you have heard about environmental public health tracking? Raise your hand. Oh, good, perfect. So I don't have to spend as much time describing it. I actually got involved in environmental public health tracking when I was at the University of Wisconsin with Dr. Henry Anderson, and was very involved in on-the-ground work collecting data that went into environmental public health tracking program there. Came to D.C., came to Georgetown, and met up with Dr. John Davies Cole, and continued my work in another another facet of environmental public health tracking. But as a quick review, since so many of you know what it is, it's really designed, and I believe, Howie, correct me if I'm wrong, it was funded right after 9/11. Was it funded before? Okay, because I know Senator Clinton, Hillary Clinton at the time, was quite a proponent of it. So it hasn't received as much money as I think most people would like, but that's sort of where we're at these days. So it does collect data on hazards, exposures, and ultimate health effects, which gets integrated within the tracking network and interpreted, analyzed and interpreted, then going forth to stakeholders who can tap into this. The reason I'm doing this quick background is because this project was a partnership between Georgetown University School of Nursing and Health Studies and D.C. Department of Health. And it was fairly organic in how it got developed. D.C. Department of Health does not have environment as part of its services. There is a separate department of the environment. And so Dr. Davies Cole was adamant to continue to connect the environment department with his department to make sure that things weren't lost in translation or the separation. So he created a 12-member technical advisory group that included people from the Department of the Environment, but also people from universities and other public health experts, includes George Washington University as well as Georgetown. During the time that I was getting oriented to this technical advisory group, I was chatting with John about having university students participate. I do community-based learning, which means students not only sit through exciting lectures on epidemiology, but actually take that information and apply it in real life situations. And so we came up with an idea that John was able to get funded through the Council of Territorial and State Epidemiologists, which was the first phase in collecting climate change indicators and environmental health indicators. This is a very structured grant that had very specific endpoints of data that we needed to collect. And the idea was to say, first of all, can we find the data? Is it there? And then secondly, how long is it going to take us to get this data? And so there was a whole range of issues, including greenhouse gas emissions, temperature changes, health impacts such as heat-related deaths, but also things such as how many public health professionals within that health department actually know about climate change, how aware are they about the impacts of climate change, as well as pollen counts for a whole range of trees and shrubs and plants. And we learned that Walter Reed does a phenomenal job of collecting that information and actually was able to turn that around pretty quick. There were some indicators that we, quite frankly, just got tired of waiting on and never got successful in getting some of that data. But that was just part of this pilot to see how nimble the health department could be in collecting a whole range of indicators. I should also add that the D.C. Department of Health does not officially have a CDC-funded environmental public health tracking program. They are working in partnership with the Maryland Department of Public Health, who's been very generous in sharing their platform and their software. But these mini grants were a way to begin to establish the collection of that data so that once it does get that platform set up, that this would be a populating in the first phases of that tracking program and available for people to use. So then we moved into the second phase. And actually that first phase, we used some of Sarah's students. I don't know if you remember that. And law students, but we also used our undergraduate EPI students to not only collect the data, but to create the report and look at what was the feasible and reliable to use. So then phase two, John wrote another grant, capacity building grant, that was funded through ASTO. And specifically, we wanted to look at health effects from the years 2007 to 2010. Somebody's not happy. And in environmental health hazard data, we looked at two indicators, ozone and particulate matter, 2.5 and 10, and then a range of demographic characteristics. The ward data, so DC is divided up into wards. One of my other classes, my health disparities students, literally took each piece of data and mapped it out because we wanted to know which wards had disproportionate numbers of hospitalizations and if climate had a bigger impact in those wards. So what did we find? Well, a PM2.5, and this is Andrew's work. He decided to go through each month over that three-year time period to see what the changes might be. The red line is the EPA standard. You can see that having lived in other communities where the air quality is much worse, DC doesn't fare too poorly. There are times during the year, in the summer typically, where those go up. And peaks typically June through August. It did exceed EPA standards five times over the course of 48 months. Overall, it didn't appear to be increasing. In fact, I'm going to back up 1 minute here. And you can actually see the trend is going down. One of the great things about DC is that there's a lot of people that use public transportation. So we don't have as much of the cars and the exhaust that can add to some of these levels. Next, PM10 concentrations were very low, and again, you see the EPA standard is way at the top there, and even though there are peaks, they always stayed substantially, significantly under the EPA standards. So the next air quality indicator we looked at was ozone, and particularly, as you know, with climate change and global warming, ozone levels tend to increase. And so we looked at the maximum eight-hour ozone concentration, again, monthly variations and averages. And again, the red line is on the top, and there are peaks and valleys, but it did stay for our monthly average below. However, they did. There were days when they did exceed the EPA standard several times. We were not able to combine weather data on the daily basis. The indicators just weren't aligning. So we stuck with the monthly averages, and I'm jumping ahead here on the right a bit because we're going into health effects in a minute. But we didn't find any significant associations with the ozone and acute myocardial infarction, which we thought we actually might see some trends there. And I'm not, one of the other things we're going to be doing or in the future is to really look at some other exposure factors, such as weather conditions, more specifically whether it was sunny, cloudy, warm, cool, to see if variations in ozone were significantly impacted by that, and if that indeed made a difference in hospitalizations. We're not expecting that to happen. But so then finally, John Davies Cole was able to arrange for large data sets from the hospital association in the district for a whole range of demographics, as well as two in particular health outcomes, one being acute myocardial infarction and asthma. This table actually was one of the tables. This is overall hospitalizations over the 3 years, and this was one of the tables the students came up with after they tagged each one of those zip codes and placed it into the ward. As you can see, Ward 8, which is one of the lower income wards, is quite high in hospitalizations. And for those of you not familiar with DC, the lower section of the southeast and the southwest tends to be lower income. We saw the majority of hospitalizations in Ward 6, 7, and 8, some in Ward 2. And this is just an example of one of the pie charts that the students put together to graphically display overall hospitalizations. So first health outcome we looked at was hospital admissions for asthma. Again, we charted this over time, those 3 years, by month, and saw some trends. The trends actually, I'm going to make you all sick. I keep going back and forth here. I didn't have coffee this morning either. Maybe that's a problem. But the trends were not what we were expecting, but actually has been confirmed by folks at, for example, Children's Medical. The trends for admissions are in spring and fall, okay? It's not when the temperatures get super high in the summer. So our next steps are to add some more indicators that might be confounding that relationship a bit, such as pollen. Gender, we were surprised to see that consistently females were significantly more likely to be hospitalized, African Americans significantly more likely to be hospitalized. And we also had data on ER visits, but these are actual hospital admissions. 0 to 9 years old were the top hot number of hospitalizations, but also 40 to 49, 50 to 59, and then below that 60 to 69. But kids were much more likely to be hospitalized for asthma. And overall, the African American population accounted for approximately 90% of all hospital admissions for asthma. The majority of these hospitalizations occurred in wards 5 and 8. Again, we're looking at CFIRST data, which is EPA data that looks at variety of exposures and toxic exposures, but other exposures as well, looking at some environmental justice issues because of the wards that seem to be suffering the most from this. And then females accounted for approximately 61.5% of all asthma-related hospitalizations. So then the second health effect we looked at was acute myocardial infarction. Again, we plotted this over time, monthly averages for 2007 to 2010, kind of all over the place. We also looked at demographics again for this. African Americans were more likely to be hospitalized, as we would absolutely anticipate. As you get older, you're more likely to be hospitalized for acute myocardial infarction. And overall, African Americans accounted for about 74% of all of those hospitalizations. Peaks were during March through May. Again, not when we're seeing the big spikes in temperature. So What we got was a whole lot of non-significance, but I thought it would be important to put this up here. Over time, we looked at from 2007 to 2010 in each one of these tables, change in hospitalizations by 0.01 parts per million increase in ozone. We got close, but it was actually reverse reverse association. Same with particulate matter 10 concentrations and asthma-related total hospitalizations. No significance there, as well as ozone and acute myocardial infarction. And the last two tables I'm going to share, we did actually quite a few, was the association between PM2.5 concentrations and acute myocardial infarctions and PM10 and acute myocardial infarction hospitalizations. So for overall, we found that for each year studied, women were significantly more likely to be admitted than men. Children 0 to 9 were more likely to be hospitalized for asthma when compared to other age groups, and African Americans were significantly more likely to be hospitalized for both asthma and myocardial infarction. So it's this type of work is expressly feasible using environmental public health tracking mechanisms. We have lots of other data that we collected in the first phase of the study, the climate indicators. So we're right now looking at the next steps, those indicators we want to include in the model to see if there's been any confounding going on. But clearly the pollen is an issue, and we're going to include that into this for sure into the next model. So environmental public health tracking can be used successfully to explore climate change and public health effects. It tells some pretty interesting stories, particularly when in a small area like DC, where we can point out those particular areas where there's low income and disproportionate exposures that might be adding to the burden. So, and the other last note I want to say is don't underestimate the abilities of undergraduate students. They're really bright and they've got a lot of passion and they can help support public health efforts. Thanks.